The practice of commenting on the scriptures is a Jewish tradition that the early church adopted. Sermons largely disappeared in the Middle Ages, I suppose much to the delight of some. But then they resurfaced with the Reformation, and we are all children of the Reformation. Since 1549, with the first Book of Common Prayer, every Eucharist calls for, prescribes, actually, a response to the Scriptures. But it is important to note that that is a plural directive to the entire assembly. The preacher is one designated to invite others into the reflection and the response so that hopefully we take it with us and our lives might change as a result. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Now you may know the name, you may not know the name Don LaFontaine, but I bet you know his voice. Before his death in 2008, LaFontaine did the voiceover for more than 5,000 movie trailers, using his trademarked gravelly husk of a voice. He was charged with conveying the film's plot and intrigue in 2 minutes or less so that folks would go see the film. You may remember a few of his more famous ones from the movie Die Hard. Remember with Bruce Willis? That was a test, see? I got you. LaFontaine's lead-in on Die Hard. He's an easy man to like, but a hard man to kill. Or Speed. Remember that bus runaway bus with Sandra Bullock? Get ready for rush hour. Or 2001, A Space Odyssey. A shrieking monolith deliberately buried by an alien intelligence. His signature catchphrase was, in a world where. You remember that? So that for the movie Alien, he began the trailer, in a world where the sun burns cold and the wind blows colder. I don't even know what that means, but he had me to go see the movie. Got my attention. Things bursting out of people's bellies and all that. Now, the excerpt of the story of Joseph from the book of Genesis that we heard read just a few moments ago by Peter, it wasn't meant to be a trailer for us per se, but it is. It may on the surface seem odd to just take that one tidbit near the end of the saga out of its context. And for my part, folks, I think the Joseph saga in the last 15 chapters of Genesis is one of the best, greatest stories, not just in all the Bible, but in all of human literature. I hope you'll go read it sometime. Last 15 chapters of Genesis. If I were a voice actor, I would envision a trailer of the saga of Joseph might go something like this. In a world where brother turns on brother, and Pharaoh's dream unsettling dreams, unexpected things happen. Jealousy, sexual intrigue, even a worldwide famine cannot extinguish the human spirit of compassion and forgiveness. A tale as old as time, yet so true for us today. All right, you got it? This cold has served some purpose for me. This story of Joseph serves as a hinge between the earlier ancient myths of the origin of humanity and the origin of creation and the origins of Israel as God's people. plotted through the covenants with individual men, Abraham and his wife Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Leah and Rachel. But then with the next generation, with Joseph's generation, the 12 sons of Jacob become the progenitors for the 12 tribes of Israel. And the covenant becomes a communal one. And there are beautiful stories of women threaded down through them, to be sure, even down to us sitting here today as the legacy of that story. You may know parts of it. Jacob plays favorites with his children. And Joseph arrogantly lords the fact that he's one of Jacob's favorites. Lords it over his brothers. Jacob is a dreamer. He is pompous. He is arrogant. He is unabashed in sharing his interpretation of others' dreams, including those of his brothers. And that gift gets him into trouble time and again throughout his life. But it also saves his life. Charisma often cuts both ways. It's part of what makes such a beautiful story. He is so relentlessly despised by his brothers because of his disrespect for them that they go and sell him into slavery just to get rid of him. It's horrible. It's tragic. They go and they tell his father that a wild animal ate him. Father Jacob is so devastated, and it's only decades later as he's approaching death as an old man that he learns the truth that no, his son is actually alive. And not just alive, Joseph has made his way through that bondage in slavery and becomes the most powerful man in all of Egypt, caring for all of the assets of Pharaoh's household because he has this uncanny capacity to interpret dreams and thereby predict what is going to happen in the future. And a famine sets in, predicted by one of the dreams that he interprets. And Joseph uses that power for good. He begins saving up the food so that people won't starve. He shares the food instead of hoarding it. He shares it with many, many people, including his starving brothers who don't recognize him when they come to beg for some food. Now, this is where a lot of storylines miss the mark, and they plot a course directly to vengeance. Joseph had it on him, could have gone right there. Think of how many films, how many books tell the story of revenge. Stop. It provides for momentary satisfaction as we see it unfold. The bad guy gets what's coming, and we stand and we cheer. The victim gets retribution and we rejoice. And the world's warp is righted just a little. Only the feeling doesn't last. Vengeance may release the tension for a moment, but the brief satisfaction erodes into an unresolved darkness. This is why families of victims who go and attend the execution of the killer of their loved one almost always say that attending that execution has just been another punch in the gut. It doesn't give them satisfaction they thought they might get. Vengeance is the easier storyline to tell. It's the easier storyline to live. It is a common one, to be sure, but our scriptures invite us to consider a different story, a deeper story, a tougher road, and how we might make it our own in our lives. Joseph left his brothers as an arrogant, petulant young man. But when they meet him years later, he's changed. Yes, he's culturally Egyptian now, and they don't recognize him. But that's not what this story is really about. This is really about a story of remarkable growth in a man. Spiritual growth, emotional growth, psychological growth. Joseph grows to become a humble man who, we're told, weeps upon his brothers. He doesn't weep in front of them. He weeps upon them, which you see means that he's having to hug them, to hold them as he's weeping. It's a powerful image. He's weeping upon them even as they are rightly fearing for their lives. He has the capacity to stop it right there. But instead, he waves the thought of that off, choosing instead to acknowledge that God was the one whose purpose is fulfilled in all of this. Humility is a virtue that can only come when one confronts an egocentric existence and yearns for something more and knows it cannot come only from within oneself. Joseph's brothers meant it for evil. I mean, let's just call it here, folks. Joseph's brothers meant it for evil. But Joseph is able to say that God used it for good. God used it for good. From his pit of desolation, Joseph gains wisdom, wisdom that will serve him and through him serve countless others. Instead of rage, Joseph has compassion. Instead of vengeance, Joseph seeks reconciliation. Instead of lording it over them, he simply forgives them. For Joseph was lost, but now is found, having found his true self. He interprets the meaning of it all for them, for us, that God sent him into Egypt ahead of the others to preserve life, to preserve their lives. What magnanimity in the moment. And the invitation comes down to us here and now. You know, the late Jungian analyst and priest John Sanford once wrote, "Evil remains evil until man's consciousness grows because of it." Let me repeat that with updated language. Evil remains evil until the human consciousness grows because of it. Then, Sanford says, God can use that evil for good. Then God can use it for good. This is why we still tell the mythic story of Joseph 3,000 years later. This is why we still tell the murder, the story of Edwin T. Pratt's murder 50 years later. This is why we will host Mirabai Star in this space next month for a writing workshop in which we are invited, those who participate are invited to trace our stories across the dark night into transformation. And we know the dark night holds the evil in the world. But we are invited to see how we come through to transformation. This is why we will make our Lenten journey again in 9 days. And in the course of our Lenten journey, we will ask each of you as adults to plan your own funeral during that season, not in some morbid drama of despair, but because I am convinced that tending to the reality of death as a part of life, attending to the reality of death is an integral part of the spiritual growth that leads to wisdom. And we all yearn for that wisdom. This is why we still tell the story of Christ crucified and resurrected, because it offers us wisdom by which we make our way in this broken, hurting world. The storylines are there for us to see, to discover a different way, to walk apart from the easier path of vengeance, to find a different path lighted by the extraordinary gifts of forgiveness and forbearance that present in a life of wisdom. And then God can use us for good.